on the beat of the issues that matter to you. If you're curious about the latest news in Canadian politics, labor, environment, or social justice, you've come to the right place. This is News for the Rest of Us, free of corporate influence. This week on Rabble Radio, Labour reporter Gabriella Kalugay-Kasuga is joined by Ethel Tungohan. Today, Tungohan and Kalugay-Kasuga discuss the expectations and assumptions of care work in Canada. Kalugay-Kasuga and Tungohan talk about Matatag, Filipina care workers during COVID-19, a photo series project by Filipina nurses, support workers, and caregivers during COVID-19. The two also talk about the invisibilization of care work in Canada, particularly for women and racialized communities, and how a complete breakdown of colonized thinking, learning, and working in Canada must take place in order for true labor equity. Ethel Tungohan is the Canada Research Chair in Canadian Migration Policy, Impacts, and Activism. She is also an Associate Professor of Politics and Social Science at York University. Dr. Tungohan's new book, Care Activism, Migrant Domestic Workers, Movement Building, and Communities of Care, is set to be released August 2023. Here are Ethel Tungohan and Gabriella Kalugay-Kasuga in conversation. Take a listen.
Thank you so much, Ethel, for joining us on Rabble Radio today.
Yeah, I'm really excited to be here.
One of the ways I was first exposed to your research was through your documenting of Filipina care workers through the Matatag project. So I was wondering if you could just tell me and our listeners a bit about that.
Absolutely. The Matatag project, and Matatag means firm and strong and someone with a strong foundation, right? So the Matatag project was done in collaboration with two organizations, the Migrant Resource Center Canada, which is based here in Toronto, and Gabriella, Ontario. And the project also has research collaborators, including Maureen Tolentino, Connolly DeLeon, Marissa Largo, Matias Guerra. And we also have a lot of researchers there as well, like RAs Micah J. Malin, Bea Sirden. I'm naming them because I think it's important to give credit. Lenny Simbre, and others as well, who've, and Angelia Natayal, who've kind of been doing the project since its inception. And the project was born out of a sense during the pandemic that there were a lot of reports being issued surrounding the experiences of doctors and how they are saving us from the pandemic, but barely any reports looking at the work done by healthcare workers, such as personal support workers, healthcare aides, licensed practical nurses. And we felt that that was a huge, huge omission in the narrative. And because the organizations that we've collaborated with represent a lot of Filipina care workers, we thought it would be good to have a project drawing attention to their experiences. And the project used this method called Photo Voice, where we actually had the care workers who were part of our study take photos and share with us their experiences of COVID through the photos that they took. And it's been exhibited in art shows in Barrie, in Toronto. I think it was also in Montreal. And it's been such a big labor of love. And I'm really, really honored to have been part of this project.
And so what are some of the things that for you, like as a researcher, you really kind of really stuck with you from those stories that you'd been hearing from care workers?
I think first, care work is important work, but also that care work is hard work. The women that we interviewed frequently experience the invisibilization of their work. And I think part of that has to do with the widespread assumption that the work that they're doing is easy and is not as high profile, say a doctor. But in actual fact, the personal support workers, the healthcare aides, the nurses who were doing this work were patients' only source of contact during the pandemic when we had social distancing requirements. So for example, some of the women who worked in long-term care homes, which had immense COVID outbreaks, some of them did, were tasked with maintaining contact with people who were living in these care homes and were tasked with helping care home residents with what we call the acts of daily living. So eating, bathing, taking walks. And a lot of this labor, I think, is invisibilized because it's primarily women who work in these professions. So care work is important, but frequently people don't see just how hard care work is. So that's one thing that I kept kind of thinking about too, right? Like just how hard it is to keep doing this work in the absence of social recognition for that. And secondly, I mean, I think another thing that I keep thinking about with respect to the project is how risky women who were working in these professions, how much they were put at risk, right? Because of the COVID pandemic, because this project was undertaken, you know, at the height of the first and second waves, the women we talked to were actually really clear about the risks that they themselves were facing. Some of them would express sentiments like, every day I put my lives at risk. And I think, you know, that's something that we don't talk often enough about, the fact that, you know, the pandemic, we were able to survive it through the work of essential workers, including these essential care workers. And so honestly, Gabby, I'm so indebted to these women because I really think that without them, Canadian society would have come to a standstill. They did such important work.
You said part of it is the misconception that it's easy work, but I'm wondering, is there anything else at play, do you think, that is invisibilizing this labor?
I think it's also because a lot of the women are racialized immigrant women. And I think when we look at larger stereotypes about people's innate capacity to do this work, a lot of folks seem to think that care work comes naturally to women and that care work comes especially naturally to racialized women. And I think that's one thing that, you know, I keep thinking about with respect to the project, that care work is work, right? That this doesn't actually come more naturally to some communities over others, that the actual act of being there for people, of bathing, of cleaning, of dispensing medication, that's intensive emotional work too. It's not just the physical constraints that you face. A lot of it is emotional, especially since at the height of the pandemic, some of the clients that the women were working with were passing away because of COVID, right? And some of the women had to be the conduit between the resident and their family members who weren't allowed to see them because of COVID lockdown provisions. So the physical act of kind of caring for someone is really exhausting, but the emotional labor involved with that is exhausting as well. And I think with respect to kind of race and gender, if we see these as being intersectional, we kind of see that these types of work, racialized women, racialized working class women have been pigeonholed into. And that's something that I think we need to talk about as well. And that's something perhaps that explains why this work continues to be underpaid and undervalued relative to other professions too.
And I kind of want to touch then on the aspect of underpaying or even not paying care work at all. You know, have you done any research into the unpaid care work that falls onto, you know, the shoulders of women?
Absolutely. Well, so for this project itself, like, I mean, the Metatag project, I'll talk about that and I'll talk about other projects. What's really interesting is that a lot of the women who were working in these homes and households weren't being paid for all of the hours that they worked. And they kept working anyway because of power structures that made it such that it was harder to say no. For some women, especially those whose immigration statuses are tied with their employers, that also meant that they live with their employers. So the power dynamics are really quite vast there, the power inequities, I mean. And so it's harder, even if your contract specifies that you're only supposed to work 8 hours a day, it's harder to kind of fight for your labor rights, knowing that, you know, if you try to be too aggressive about it, your employers could say, well, you know what? I don't need your services anymore. Thank you so much. Goodbye. And what then happens is not only do you lose your job, you also lose your immigration status here, right? So when we think about, you know, all of these reasons for why it's harder for some care workers to ask to be paid for all of the work that they've provided, we have to look at these larger power structures as well. I think, you know, beyond kind of the Metatag project, what's really interesting is that, you know, when it comes to the care work that women have been asked to do, I think it's hard because there's this expectation that women are innate nurturers. So even in my job as a professor, there is the expectation that my job isn't just like researching and teaching, it's also providing emotional labor and emotional support. And so there's an emerging body of work showing that for a lot of female professors, and not even just professors, but women in other professions, there's the expectation that they should provide that type of emotional labor to keep institutions running. And they're not, and we're not compensated for that too, right? And I think it makes it a little bit harder to kind of think about women's rights in that way, because I think when you think about emotional labor, that's not something that frequently factors into how workplaces think about kind of workplace responsibilities, right? So if you're trying to be paid for all of the work you've put in, it's not like on a timesheet you can put as part of your tasks, emotional support, right? So a lot of this goes unpaid, and more kind of crucially, a lot of this goes unrecognized too.
So how can we, you know, fight to have this emotional labor, you know, recognized and even compensated?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I think it depends on the sector that you're part of. And I also think it depends on how institutions themselves see value and see worth. And one of the great things that I'm seeing post-pandemic is a lot of folks, a lot of workers are just not content to keep things running the way they're usually ran. So one of the most inspiring things to witness during the pandemic is the emergence of more social movement activists asking for better labor conditions. And I think beyond asking for better labor conditions, a lot of these activists are also asking to overturn inequitable power structures. So it's not just about kind of compensation, although of course that's something we should factor in, but it's also about thinking of other ways of running these companies, these universities, these care homes, right? And that could be thinking about how people there are also ensnared in these power relationships as well, right? And thinking about how, for example, the university can also be a site of colonialism and white supremacy, right? So what I'm trying to say is that, you know, one of the things I'm noticing is people aren't just looking at policy solutions such as pay equity, which I think is important. They're also looking at the structural foundations of these flawed institutions to see, well, maybe we want to move towards abolishing these power structures. So yeah, no, I think that's what's really cool, witnessing the emergence of these movements for change.
And I was curious, could you give me some specifics of kind of the power structures you're seeing at play that affect you personally, like, you know, within the university as a professor?
One, I mean, it's all intersecting, right? And I think, you know, within universities, what we're seeing is the intersection between the neoliberal university, which mandates that, you know, students are there as future workers, which sees value in terms of, you know, the money that it brings rather than going into what universities were meant to do, which is that universities, institutions of higher learning are supposed to be sites for emancipation. They're supposed to be sites for fostering critical thinking, right? So neoliberal values have increasingly seeped into university structure. So that's kind of one structure, but that also intersects with colonial structures too. So even the modes through which classes are taught and research is conducted, a lot of these prop up colonial modes of thinking, where, you know, for example, researchers, academics, professors are seen as the sole holders of knowledge, right? And are seen as the ones who know more. But in actual fact, as we all know, we shouldn't think about this in terms of a hierarchy. We should think about how communities themselves have the knowledge to create new theories, right? So, I mean, there's a lot of other structures that are part of universities, but really I see neoliberalism and colonialism as being part and parcel of the way universities operate. And that's something I'm really, really uncomfortable with, right? And I think one of the things that universities do is that they try to kind of, and this is the corporate university, they try to co-opt, right? Like social movement ideals. And then the way they co-opt it is, you know, it actually gets diluted. So, you know, for example, a lot of universities now have equity, diversity, inclusion, and increasingly they're putting in another D, decolonization programs. And At face value, these principles are about structural transformation, but what we're seeing universities do is dilute these principles. So it's not about structural transformation, but about, say, you know, hiring more diverse professors or having more diverse students. And that doesn't change kind of the power imbalances that are still at play, and that doesn't change the structural inequities, right? So yeah, I find that really frustrating at times.
And to kind of bring it back to care work, you know, like the hiring, if these diversity hiring practices, if there's no addressing of these structural inequities, that's just more people who are being hired to also do this unpaid emotional labor and care work. Yeah, so yeah. I was just wondering, how does this affect, you know, labor outcomes for women and specifically racialized women when they have this extra responsibility on top of everything else?
So not speaking exclusively of universities, but also in a lot of other professional settings, this extra demand to provide emotional labor, which is uncompensated, and frequently you can see that it's also undervalued by managers. One thing that does is it derails people's ability to advance in their careers, right? So to kind of concretize this, I get a lot of emails from people asking me to provide support, right? And, you know, I'm usually okay responding to these requests. A lot of the requests that actually I'm honored to receive come from racialized women, come from people from minority communities who want help with research, who want help in terms of the academy, who want help with understanding kind of, you know, how to get a job in Canada, right? Because a lot of my work is on immigration. And, you know, I also have a podcast, Academic Aunties. And so I think my networks expand because of that podcast too. And I like receiving these asks. And a lot of my time is spent kind of answering emails, meeting people one-on-one. And a lot of my students as well ask me for not just academic support, but also emotional support as well. But what that does is that it takes time away from me writing a book or me, you know, writing a journal article or me pursuing a funded opportunity, right? Because we only have a limited number of hours to be able to do work, right? Like the rest of the time, I'm also a mom. I also have elderly parents. So let me be clear, like I like providing support, right? But when that support, when that advocacy work, when that, you know, work that we do when we want to support equity-seeking communities, when that work doesn't get recognized, that means that, you know, our career stalls at a certain level, right? Because the way a lot of workplaces evaluate progression through kind of the career ladder is through these like different metrics, such as productivity, such as if you're, you know, in a corporate world, I don't know, like increased sales, increased client base, right? But that doesn't, the emotional labor that you do sometimes gets in the way of meeting these other career metrics as well. And, you know, I think for me, I don't know, I'm at a place where I've made peace with that, because I think one thing I'm trying to do is figure out what success means for me and not what, you know, the workplace defines success as looking like, right? And so doing a lot of the advocacy work, the support work, you know, the activism that I do, that I think is more important to me at this stage of my life than trying to come up the career ladder. That being said, though, you know, perhaps if we get a system where we recognize the validity of the care work that we do, that the advocacy work that we do, if we recognize that as being important, maybe then it wouldn't derail so many people, so many women in particular, from achieving career ascension, from advancing in the career ladder.
We had talked a lot about, you know, care work and kind of some of the inequities that, you know, expectations of unpaid care work. And so I kind of wanted to connect this then to your forthcoming book about care activism. Can you tell me a bit about that book? And are there any kind of solutions that, you know, you have found through working on it?
Yeah, Care Activism is a book that stemmed from my PhD dissertation, but I've worked on it since then. And it is a book looking at migrant domestic workers in Canada, but I also talk about migrant domestic workers in other countries and the social movements that they founded in order to seek not just policy changes, but actual societal transformations to ensure widespread gender equity, racial equity, right? And the book is a labor of love. I interviewed one-on-one 103 activists in Canada, more when you factor in the interviews I conducted outside Canada. And I also did what we call like ethnographic research. So I, you know, hung out in meetings, went to rallies, went to Geneva for the discussion on the Convention on Domestic Work. I went at that point to Quezon City in the Philippines, 2011, for the International Migrants Alliance meetings. And the book just documents how, you know, when we think about the work that migrant domestic workers put in to create these movements, we can't just understand these movements in terms of the policy changes that they've put forth, or even in terms of the discourses surrounding the value of care work that they've put into the world. We also need to look at the way they fostered care among migrant care workers themselves, right? And how through these organizations, migrant care workers were able to feel supported, how migrant care workers and their families who've joined them in Canada or who were still back home in countries like the Philippines feel that they're part of this network of people who can boost them up and who affirm to them that their lives are important and that their experiences at work, that those matter too. Because increasingly, what I found is that because care workers is so invisibilized, a lot of people assume that, you know, care workers themselves by extension are not important. And what these groups do, what these advocacy circles do, is they actually say, you know what? Care work matters, right? What you do is important, and your experiences and your family's experiences, that's important too. And so it might seem like a small thing, but I find that, you know, when you look at the way these movements operate, being able to act as what we call dissident friends for each other, being able to bear witness to each other's challenges and also to celebrate each other's milestones, that's really powerful. And so that was a really rambly description of what the book is about, but it's out August 2023, and I'm really, really jazzed by it. There's so many amazing folks whose narratives form the basis for the book. It's such an honor to have been part of, you know, telling their stories through this book.
Yeah, it sounds beautiful. And it sounds like, you know, you've really touched on one way that we can fight this invisibilization of labor is through, like, you know, recognizing these advocacy groups and kind of the solidarity that they're building within these groups.
100%, for sure. I think one thing that kind of makes me so annoyed is when, you know, changes to, I don't know, the caregiver program, right? Because there were changes recently announced, that these changes are announced almost as though, you know, the government was just like, oh, we just decided to do this because we're really good. We're really good people. No, like a lot of these changes, every single one of the improvements that we've seen within Canada's caregiver program only took place because care workers themselves asked for them because they mobilized, right? So I think that's an important part of the narrative, and we really should recognize how important their activism is.
Yeah, for sure. Well, thank you so much for joining me on the show today. Yeah, and thank you so much for all the research that you've been putting out, and I look forward to reading your book.
Thank you.
Was Rabble Labor reporter Gabriella Kaluge-Kasuga and Ethel Tungahun in conversation. Thanks so much for that, Gabby and Ethel. Now it's time for a segment we like to call In Case You Missed It, and for that, we'll hand it over to Nick Seabrook. Take it away, Nick.
Thanks, Brianne. This week, Rabble parliamentary reporter Carl Nirenberg shares that Canada's major grocery chains continue to push back against accusations that they are engaged in price gouging. Canada's largest grocery mogul, Garlin Weston III, was grilled by NDP leader Jagmeet Singh during a House of Commons committee meeting on March 8th about the alleged $1 million a day in excess profits his company, Loblaws, generated in 2022. Weston countered that his company actually only made $1 on a $25 bag of groceries. However, $1 is still a 4% profit margin. And seeing how earlier this year, one package of chicken breasts at a Loblaws in downtown Toronto was selling for $40, a $25 bag of groceries really isn't all that much. Canada's Competition Bureau is looking into the food retail industry. Not only have prices and profits steeply risen for Canada's largest grocery chains, but just three companies, Loblaws, Metro, and Empire, control 80% of Canada's grocery industry. In environmental news, Rabble's Kia Lucero reports that Alberta's energy regulator and Imperial Oil are downplaying the impact the province's largest toxic oil tailings spill is having on the environment, but Indigenous communities are raising the alarm. On February 4th, an overland breach of 5.3 million liters of toxic tailings spilled from Imperial Curl Mine into the Athabascan watershed near Wood Buffalo, Alberta. This latest spill, however, is not the first. The Athabascan, Chipewyan First Nation state that there have been four separate instances of the Curl Mine tailings seeping into the groundwater since May of 2022. The Alberta Energy Regulator and Imperial Oil state that the leak has not negatively affected the local water or wildlife, but the Athabascan, Chipewyan First Nations state that after they conducted a flyover of the site, toxic contamination from the spill is still visible and wildlife like moose were spotted in the area, raising concerns for their traditional food supply. Canada's Environment Minister Steve Guilbeault stated that if the Alberta Energy Regulator will not do a thorough investigation of the spill, that his department would step in to take a closer look for themselves. In Ontario provincial politics, a by-election was held this week in the riding of Hamilton Centre. Ontario NDP candidate Sarah Jama was running to win the seat once held by former Ontario NDP leader Andrea Horvath. Jama faced calls for the NDP to withdraw her candidacy after allegations of anti-Semitism were leveled against her by B'nai B'rith Canada and the Toronto Star. B'nai B'rith state that they want to see Jama's candidacy withdrawn because she supports the boycott, divest, and sanctions movement against the Israeli government. The Star claimed that she had connections to a pro-Palestinian rights group when she was a student at McMaster University. Despite these calls, over 120 members of Ontario's Jewish community signed a letter in support of Jama that was published by Independent Jewish Voices Canada. The letter applauds Jama for her longtime work as disability activist in Hamilton and states that, quote, "We desperately need an MPP like Sarah, who is connected to communities and connects communities. She has our vote, our confidence, and our trust," end quote. The results of the by-election were not available at the time of recording. And finally, join Off the Hill next week as we discuss the 2023 Canadian federal budget. The federal budget for 2023 is soon to be announced. Who decides the budget, who influences it, and where does all that money go? Our guests will dissect these questions and more in our Off the Hill panel this month. Guests include MP Leah Gazan, Rabble columnist and policy researcher Chuka Ejekam, economist David MacDonald, and Rabble parliamentary reporter Carl Nirenberg. Save your spot for this free event today. Join us March 23rd, 2023 at 7:30 p.m. Eastern, 4:30 p.m. Pacific. As always, you can find the full version of these stories and much, much more on rabble.ca.
Thanks, Nick. And that's it for Rabble Radio this week. Thank you to all the journalists and writers who contributed to this week's content on rabble.ca, and thank you to Carl Nirenberg for supplying the music. Lastly, thank you to you for tuning in to Rabble Radio. I'm Brianne Doyle, and I'll talk to you next week. Thank you.
Radio Rewind. Now we wait it. Radio Rewind. Now we wait it. Radio Rewind. Radio Rewind. The following content has previously aired on CJSF. But don't worry, we'll be back next week with fresh content. CJSF 90.1 FM. Diverse. Independent. Yours.